Welcome to the Smart Plus Connected Communities Institute Learning Series. We're speaking today with Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability for the City of Portland, Oregon. Portland is often referred to as one of the greenest cities in the world. To what do you attribute that?
I think a lot of the Portland story is that we started down the path a long time ago. So you go back to the 60s or 70s, the rest of the U.S. is, you know, kind of pursuing the American dream, where they're all pushing out with huge freeway networks. And we were, I think, at that time already thinking about resource conservation, energy conservation, quality of life, you know, affordable living, more compact urban form. And the result of that, I think, is that we're seen as a green city, both for reasons that are sort of visible and invisible. And some of the visible ones are, I mean, if you lived here, you know, it's green. You know, there's parks everywhere, there's trees everywhere, beautiful downtown, there's, you know, farmers markets, gardens everywhere. So you kind of see the green. I think what we're known for people who look at sort of the indicators of being a sustainable or green city is things like cutting carbon emissions, reducing energy bills, and a lot of programs that we've had focused on things like solar energy, which you don't, you know, think of as the first thing when you think of the rainy Northwest. But our efforts have been around efforts where city, government, neighborhoods, business, academic institutions kind of all come together. And so a good example of that is something we call Solarize Portland. And it started as a neighborhood-based effort where families got together to buy solar PV systems. And the idea was, what if a bunch of neighbors got together and maybe 100 families signed up together and put out a bid for solar and could reduce the cost by buying in bulk? And so we started that up probably 3 years ago, and now we have four or five neighborhoods doing it. Lots of other cities around the state are trying out the model. This is kind of a simple idea, but it's something that's really taken, you know, really kind of shot off. And so I think there's a lot of really simple ideas that kind of merge community-based marketing and technology together, and those things have taken off.
Just out of curiosity, are you using the feed-in tariff model that is so big in Germany?
We are, to some extent, very limited. It's piloting here with the utilities. We have some very extensive tax credits, state tax credits that have been around for a long time, both for energy efficiency and solar. And so the combination of utility incentives, tax credits, state and federal, you know, if you're a business, you can get as much as 70 or 80% of the cost of the system taken care of. And so, and about half if you're a resident. So right now there's still a real good push. And, you know, we've done this as much as an economic development strategy as it's been sort of an environmental strategy. And by kind of growing demand, we've also really pushed for many solar and other sort of sustainable product companies to be startups here, or to have sort of their European or Asian companies that are having their headquarters here. It's really a kind of a combined strategy.
Oregonians seem to pride themselves on doing things differently from other U.S. communities. Perhaps the urban growth boundary is one example of this mindset. Can you give an overview of both the concept and how well or badly it has stood the test of time? And is it something you'd recommend other communities to institute?
So the framework, again, for the urban growth boundary goes way back to the 70s. It's a statewide requirement, and so people think of it as a Portland thing, but it's something that's set regionally. So the original focus was to protect farm and forest land. And so it was literally sort of a ring around the urban area, all urban areas in the state. So for Portland, that means it's an area that includes three counties and 20 plus cities. And again, it was originally for protecting farm and forest land, kind of deciding what could be developed and what should remain rural. But, you know, here 40 years later, it's I'd say it's an evolving experiment. One of the key benefits, and it wasn't an outcome that we were focused on, is I think it's really been the key to us being able to reduce carbon emissions. And as sales reaches $4 a gallon, it's the key for us being able to save money as gas prices rise, because we have an urban area that's more dense, easier to get around by public transit, bikes, walking, you know, all of those things. So we have less commuting, you know, more robust central city, all of those things. That wasn't because of the urban growth boundary alone. I think it's a central tool, but you also have to have quality housing near downtown. You know, we have a really robust bicycle system. You have to have good transit. You have to have it. Another thing people don't think about, and this is really hard to change once your community's built, but Portland's built around these great walkable blocks. So our blocks are really short, which means you can get around on foot really easy. And when you have a city like where I lived in L.A. when I was a kid, where the blocks are huge, suburban areas, it's really hard to walk anywhere because you can't. There's no paths. There's no way to cut through. And so just to get from one point to another, sometimes you have to walk half a mile. So, you know, I think Portland's, sometimes I say we're trying to be a mini New York. You know, for a mid-sized city, we're trying to take a mix of land use tools, transportation planning, incentives, and act like a much bigger city than we really are by trying to sort of create density in a way that encourages people to, you know, want to live in places where they can walk and get around and get the things they need, you know, much more easily. But even in the suburbs, at this point, the idea that, and a lot of reason why people move here, you know, and most people, 25 years ago, half the people that are here now didn't live here. They lived somewhere else. So we're definitely a new city in terms of the people that live here. And it became, people wanted to be in a place where you could do those things. Even if you're in some of the suburban locations, they're still beginning to develop sort of these core mini downtown kind of, you know, regional hubs where you know, even if you had to drive, you'll have to drive to one spot and then you can get out and walk. And we do really well and call it a really sustainable city, but that's because we're graded on a curve and the bar's really low in the U.S. You know, we might get an A in the U.S., but the bar is set so low that there's so much more we actually need to do. You know, and then in terms of other cities having an urban growth boundary, it's the reason it's worked is it's regional and it's kind of backed up by the state. We have to do it. And so that gives our elected officials backbone. They can always say no to development because they can blame the state or the regional government. And, you know, from that perspective, it's one of the reasons why it works. It's really hard. A lot of people, friends of mine that are mayors and such in other cities, they, you know, have a really hard time facing up to developers and saying no and trying to keep a boundary there. But ours is one step removed, so we kind of have to prove it to the state why we would need to move the boundary.
What other sustainability-related plans or initiatives have been especially successful or hold particular promise in Portland?
Some things that, you know, in the past that were really successful that I think we've learned a lot from. And again, probably what we learn is about how to do these things. It's not so much about the topic. The topics change, whether it's green building or solar or water conservation or, you know, growing green duds. But the how you do it kind of stays the same, and it's important to have, you know, really strong policy direction, really strong political and business leadership. One of the things that comes to mind is that, for example, the Green Building Initiative we did, well, now it's been a decade ago. I used to run an office called the Office of Sustainable Development for the city, and so I think it was 1999. We were working with Austin, Texas, and so they were doing a whole lot of stuff in what was called green building, and We had a real partnership around the idea that we'd all been working on energy efficiency for like 20 years, and it was really boring, mm-hmm. and no one cared about it because you can't see it. It's all hidden in the walls and motors and mechanical systems. So we sort of focused on what we called green building at that time to make it something that people could see and touch and feel, and it was light, air-filled spaces, and, you know, it was, you know, recycled paint, and it was all these things that people wanted. The energy stuff kind of comes along with it, but at first, that's not, you know, something that you can sell very well. So we just, I think it was 2000 or 2001, we adopted a rule that said if you wanted any new city facility, you have to meet what was the LEED green building standard. So I think it was just at the basic level or silver level at that point. Now it's at gold that you have to meet it. But if you wanted to, if we were building a city building, we had to do that. And if you wanted to build anything commercial or multifamily and got any type of a city incentive, and so there's all sorts of low-interest loans, tax increment financing and such that developers have in most major cities. So if you were doing any of that, you had to have meet the green building standard also. And that changed everything because if you wanted to get one of those projects as a developer, you had to have someone with green building expertise on your staff. And that really built our green building industry. So we thought what we were doing was this environmental thing. And we thought we were helping businesses save money in the long run and those kinds of things. But what really happened was we now have architects, engineers, designers, manufacturers, you know, selling these services, you know, all over the U.S., all over the world, really, from Portland, because we did sort of this focused effort on green building. We thought for our own, we thought it was for our own community at first, but realized pretty quickly that it was something that we could sell to everybody else.
What is the city's vision and strategy for sustainability over the next 30 years or so? And also, if you would, just touch on what are the main challenges?
I can talk about my vision for sustainability, I think. And at this point, you know, the cool thing that's happened in the past 2 years is we did have, you know, for, I don't know, 100 years, Portland had a really strong, kind of well-known focus on planning, urban planning, design, and then, you know, 10 years ago we started the Sustainable Development Office, and we merged them together 2 years ago. And by doing that, we kind of bring, we have like a whole bag of tools to use now. So we have, you know, urban design and zoning and code, but we also have this other set of tools of technical assistance and financial, you know, kind of new financial tools and education and training and kind of partnership building, which is very different than the traditional thing a city does. So we've kind of brought those things together, which I think anyways will help the city sort of move forward on sustainability. And, you know, for me, sustainability is, it's a really, it's a poor word. It's a word that everyone describes differently, has a different understanding of it. For some people, it just means green and the environment. For others, it means sort of that triple bottom line, environment, economy, social equity. To me, sustainability isn't about those individual pieces. It's that all of these things are connected. The environment, jobs, our community, our personal health, and that if you mess up one part of the system, it all begins to fail. And the second idea is really that everything we do today affects tomorrow. So sustainability, again, is not just about the environment. It's about the future and about connections. So everything we buy and how we get to work and what we eat, all those things have an impact on the future and, you know, kind of what kind of world we leave our kids. So I think it's a really different way to think about it. It's really hard for people to think about it this way because it, instead of the individual pieces, like thinking it's about air quality or water quality or, you know, green jobs, it's more about the interconnections and how we do these things. So I'm trying to get that vision of sustainability out there and getting people, because it's something that's, it's not ideological. It's not like Republican or Democrat. You don't have to be a Portland hipster. It's more about thinking about how we use our infrastructure, how do we save money for business and residents, you know, how do we just kind of have common sense ways of doing things. So it's been a fun process to try to get that thought out to companies, because it sort of shifts the way people are thinking, instead of just having them trying to focus on, you know, solar or water conservation. They're trying to look more holistically, like, at their whole process. So it's a different way. So for Portland, you know, next steps are to kind of shift from thinking just about, you know, my house or my business, and try to think about, one of the words we're using is eco-districts, you know, taking sort of the principles of green building and spreading them out to a larger district. So we're looking at the building and transit and bicycling and water use and stormwater management and, you know, urban agriculture, all of those things kind of combined. And so we have a couple, I guess I call them kind of living laboratories, two areas of the city. Well, actually, there's a couple more, but two that are moving pretty quickly. One near Portland State and one in an area of Northeast Portland called the Lloyd District, where we're looking at how can we integrate all these systems together and look at the kind of political and financial system you'd need in place to really push it kind of to the next level, which includes everything from, you know, having really vibrant streetcars, light rail, bike lanes, you know, and infrastructure for plug-in electric cars, all of those things together. And that takes some real kind of social organizing of the area to make those things move forward. So that's kind of the fun stuff we're working on right now is how do we, part of it, I guess I almost call it a village concept, trying to make healthy, connected neighborhoods in different areas of the city that kind of function as smaller communities.
And what are some of the main challenges?
Political leadership. So you need someone willing to take the reins and lead and make hard decisions about very limited dollars and what's going to be used, because it's, you know, every city government, every business, you know, has very limited funding, and it's hard to make choices thinking long term instead of short term. Similarly, I guess, business leadership. So you can't succeed at this stuff if just the city government wants to do it. You really need corporate leadership, small business, you know, large businesses. You need their entrepreneurship to kind of push the stuff forward, and then you need a really motivated populace, people who want to take action. Those are just three small things.
What top three lessons learned can you share with other communities around the world?
I think that kind of builds up the challenges. You really need to have focus. You need to have a long-term plan that the community buys into. And you need political leadership for that. You need business leadership for that. You need sort of grassroots connection to that. And so again, it's less about the topic and more about how you build sort of the structure of support for what you're trying to get done. And then while you're doing all that, you know, big thinking planning, you need to jump right in and do some stuff right away. And that would be sort of my first lesson learned, is don't just do a plan. Get three or four things that you can succeed at right away, because people need stuff that they can see and touch and feel in order to feel like things are moving, things are happening, whether it's, you know, small stuff like making changes in energy efficiency or, you know, or solar, or whether it's a large plan, you know, that you're trying to do. You still need to do small stuff first, and one of those things is kind of getting city government to be a model. So you can't be out preaching to all the businesses and residents in town if you aren't recycling and reusing and, you know, being energy efficient and water efficient as a government. So you got to do that stuff first. Otherwise, you're not credible. And I guess the other thing I think really a lesson learned is a lot of times it's really fun to go do something flashy, you know. And I'm the first one to love solar and smart grid and electric cars and all these other things. But sometimes the best answers are really low tech. So having, you know, one of the most powerful solutions we've come up with for reducing climate change is to have corner grocery stores. If there was a place that you could walk to, you didn't have to go get in your car to go get, you know, the six things you need when you know, because those are all of our little trips that add up that are huge. And so there's a whole bunch of little low-tech solutions like that, you know, making it cheap and easy to insulate your house, it's you know, the answer isn't all new technology and new applications. A lot of it's really simple stuff.
For more sustainable urban development podcasts, go to www.smartconnectedcommunities.org.